From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, sitting in for Terry Gross. Rivethead maybe isn't the nicest thing one person can call another, but it's what Ben Hamper's co-workers called him during the 11 years he worked on the assembly line at General Motors. On this edition of Fresh Air, Rivethead recalls what life was like on the line at GM. In 1982, the Israelis invaded Lebanon, and at the same time, the World Cup soccer games took place in Barcelona. We'll talk with Israeli filmmaker Eran Rickless, whose new film, Cup Final, ties the two unrelated events together. And book critic John Leonard reviews When Nietzsche Wept, the new novel by Irvin D. Yalom, author of the bestseller Love's Executioner. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Republicans opened their convention today in Houston and quickly ratified a conservative party platform. Tonight's primetime session is designed to solidify conservative support for the president. The speakers include conservative challenger Patrick Buchanan and will culminate in a speech from former President Ronald Reagan. The platform proceedings moved swiftly after abortion rights supporters acknowledged they didn't have the votes to bring the issue to a floor debate. The platform also includes proposals for constitutional amendments to require a balanced budget and to limit the terms of elected officials. Bush campaign operatives continue to raise questions about Bill Clinton's character. The new round of attacks comes as a new poll indicates a majority of Americans think marital infidelity is not an important issue, although it's been raised against both candidates. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Clinton campaign today called for President Bush to live up to his threats and fire the U.S. Treasurer and campaign chairman Robert Mosbacher for raising the issue of infidelity. On Sunday, Mosbacher told delegates that Clinton's alleged infidelity should be one of the yardsticks by which voters measure the candidates. The U.S. Treasurer called San Antonio Mayor Henry Cisneros, a member of the Clinton campaign, and Governor Clinton, two skirt chasers. President Bush said he would fire any member of his staff who injected a candidate's private life into the White House race. But today, Mr. Bush distanced himself from that edict and said he couldn't be responsible for everything everyone in his campaign says. The program is to stay far away from the sleaze business, he said, but the Democrats are just as guilty of it. It's that kind of a year. Meanwhile, in a Houston Chronicle poll of 500 registered voters, 66% said infidelity is not an important issue in the campaign. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Houston.
The French government said today that it's resuming its airlift of humanitarian aid to Somalia. Earlier this month, France sent more than 2,000 tons of supplies to the famine-stricken East African country. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
The French government said it will resume its shipments of humanitarian supplies to Somalia later this week. Officials said food and medicine will be flown in from Djibouti, which is a former French colony in East Africa. France continues to station troops there. Officials said France will maintain the airlift for about 10 days, with the objective of flying some 200 tons of food and medical supplies to southwest Somalia. The aid will be distributed by the International Red Cross. Earlier this month, the French Minister of Health, once a founding member of the French relief group Doctors Without Borders, visited Somalia. He said the famine there was worse than what he'd seen in Biafra and Nigeria in the 1960s, and he called on the international community to do more to help Somalia. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Dow Jones Industrials lost 4 points today to close at 3,324. This is NPR. Representatives of Islamic countries at the United Nations said today that they'll call for a special session of the UN General Assembly to deal with the crisis in Bosnia. Turkish Ambassador Mustafa Aksin, who chairs the Islamic group, told the Reuters news agency he hoped a general session could be held before August 26th. That's when an international conference on the former Yugoslavia is to be held in London. Islamic countries are concerned for the Muslim population of Bosnia. A study by the National Association of Black Journalists says coverage of the rioting in Los Angeles was unbalanced because there are too few black editors across the country. Don Gagne reports.
The report, entitled A Look at the Riots and Beyond, notes that only 4.8% of journalists working at the nation's daily newspapers are black. That compares to a figure of 3.1% from a decade ago. It goes on to say that editorial decisions are often made without any input by minority journalists. According to the study, much of the coverage of the L.A. riots was exaggerated. It charges that conflicts between Koreans and blacks in L.A. were blown out of proportion, and that looting of Korean-owned stores by Hispanics was overlooked. The conclusions the report draws were based on interviews with black reporters and an evaluation of stories filed during and after the violence, which erupted after the acquittal of those charged in the beating of Rodney King. The study will be officially released Wednesday at the Association's annual convention in Detroit, which is expected to be attended by some 2,000 black journalists. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
United Nations weapons inspectors said today that Iraq has cooperated with them by providing important new information about its ballistic missile program. A spokesman for the UN Weapons Commission said that the inspectors did not attempt to enter any Iraqi ministries during their 10-day tour. The UN spokesman said that another nuclear weapons inspection team will go to Iraq later this month. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. For more than 10 years, Ben Hamper spent his days on the assembly line at the General Motors plant in Flint, Michigan. He assumed he'd be there for life, just as his father and grandfather had been. But Hamper discovered he had another talent. After work, he began jotting down observations about life on the line. And when he sent a record review to the local alternative paper, they printed it. Turns out the editor was Michael Moore, who would go on to direct the GM-bashing film Roger and Me. Moore felt that the review was so wonderfully sick, he offered Hamper his own weekly column. Impressions of a Rivethead, named for one of Hamper's jobs on the line, became one of the most popular columns in the Flint Voice. I spoke with Hamper last summer, after his tales from the assembly line were published in the book Rivethead. Rivethead has just been released in paperback. Here's Hamper reading from the first chapter.
I was 7 years old the first time I ever set foot inside an automobile factory. The occasion was family night at the old Fisher Body Plant in Flint, where my father worked a second shift. General Motors provided this yearly intrusion as an opportunity for the kin of the workforce to funnel in and view their fathers, husbands, uncles, and granddads as they toiled away on the assembly line. If nothing else, this annual peep show lent a whole world of credence to our father's daily grumble. The assembly line did indeed stink. The noise was very close to intolerable. The heat was one complete bastard. Little wonder the old man's socks always smelled like liverwurst bleached for a week in the desert sun. For my mother, it was at least one night out of the year when she could verify the old man's whereabouts. One night a year when she could be reasonably assured that my father wasn't lurching over a pool table at the patio lounge or pickling his gizzard at any one of the 1,000 beer joints out on Dort Highway. My father loved his drink. He wasn't nearly as fond of labor.
You write that before visiting the automobile plant, you thought that your father built cars all by himself. When you first saw an assembly line, what was your reaction?
Actually, I was quite terrified. Because I'd never seen anything like this. It was so huge and enormous and noisy and filthy that I actually felt, sorry for my father. You know, I just assumed that he went to some glitzy little garage and, you know, built the cars out of kits or something, you know.
So what you saw then was a real glimpse into...
My future.
Into your future, your father's present and your future.
Mm-hmm.
What did GM do to make families, or to try to make families, feel part of the company?
Not much, I guess, you know. Once a year, I think they let the families come through. And, of course, they were all under the umbrella of the wonderful GM benefits package. But... Otherwise, I don't really know what else they did.
Was GM able to create some kind of identity or even a sense of loyalty for the people that worked there?
In Flint, Michigan, certainly, yes. It was a family tradition, you know. I'm a fourth-generation shop rat, or was. And, You know, it was just handed down from, you know, generation to generation. Your father would get you an application once you got out of high school, and you'd sign up, and it was just like going in the Army, you know. Well, except you went in for 30 years.
It was the only game in town, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. In Flint, if you don't work for GM, I mean, you pump gas or you flip burgers or you just sit by railroad tracks and, you know, watch the sun come up and go down.
You describe being part of this generation of shop rats, your father, your grandfather, aunts and uncles, and a whole extended family. How did you resist General Motors?
How did I resist it initially?
Yes.
Well, I got out of high school, and I was just bound and determined. I thought, you know, I was very cynical, and I had this naive belief that, you know, I was somehow talented and you could do more than just put a screw in a hole. And so I wasted about 3 prime earning years with that belief in near poverty before I realized that I was kidding myself. And I was paying in apartments for, like, minimum wage, and I already had a wife and daughter. And it came time to pay the bills, and so I opted to sign on the dotted line.
When you first started working for General Motors, you were assigned to the cab shop, which was known as the Jungle. Can you describe what it was like, your first day on the job?
It was very terrifying. They led us up to the Jungle, which is on the second floor, where they do all the welding on the cab bodies. And there's sparks shooting everywhere in every direction. And people are MIG welding and spot welding and brazing. Just lots of heat, noise, fire, and, you know, the overall claustrophobia of all these wires hanging down and huge cables looping everywhere. It was just, to me, a horrific scene. And I remember that first day I hired in, I said, well, what I'll do is I'll make it to the end of this shift, and then it's bye-bye, I'm going to look for something else. Maybe I can still become a disc jockey or something.
You describe the noise, and you say it's like it was like some hideous, unrelenting tape loop of trains having sex. I almost know what you're talking about when you write that.
I like that line. If you really think of it, that's what it was like. Imagine trains having sex, you know, if you can possibly imagine that, going on for like 8 hours a day, and that's about what it was like.
I noticed, too, on your first day on the job that the foreman or the overseer called you boys. Was that what bosses called workers, boys?
Some did. This guy happened to. You know, I didn't take any, you know, personal affront to the thing. Sometimes they called you. Well, I can't say it here. Is this a family radio show? I mean, everything from... A lot of times they referred to us as bodies. I didn't like that. Like some department would be short a few workers on a Friday because guys didn't come into work on Friday or something, and the foreman would shout out, hey, we need a couple bodies over in, you know, the axle line. You know, I thought, ooh, bodies. Hmm. You know.
You didn't think of yourself as a body.
Well, you know, when I think of a body, I think of a cadaver, you know. Of course, a lot of us, you know, felt like cadavers in there sometimes.
Ben Hamper is my guest, and he worked on the GM assembly line and has written a book about those years, and they were from 1977 to 1988. The book is called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. Reading about your book, it sort of reminded me a little bit of what you also seem to describe as your Catholic education.
Yeah, there's similarities.
Can you tell us more about that, those similarities?
Jeez. Well, outside of the fact that, you know, I never swallowed a lot of the stuff that the nuns crammed down my throat, and I never swallowed a lot of the hokey bunkum that a lot of the supervisors like to cram down our throat. That was probably the biggest, you know, parallel.
So you never went for it?
No. You know, it was actually demeaning at times. I write about... our in-plant mascot. They actually dreamt up a mascot for us, which was this, like, 5'6" gigantic kitty cat named how we make them. And it was a guy in a cat suit with a large, huge, enormous cat head with whiskers and a cape with a Q on it that stood for quality. And he'd romp around, come down the aisles, just like, you know, it was a football game back in junior high, you know. And you know, that kind of stuff was just preposterous and demeaning after a while. We ran with the joke at first, but, you know, it just, it really, when we thought about it after a while, we said, oh, my God, this is what they think of us, you know, that we're just these zombie nitwits, you know, that can only relate to, you know, cartoon character figures or something.
After working in the cab shop, you went to the rivet line, and you said that it kind of got into your blood. You got a certain satisfaction out of doing the rivets. Tell us what you did.
Well, I had a couple different jobs down there, but they both revolved around riveting pieces of equipment onto the frame. But I just had this sick fascination with rivets and riveting. I enjoyed it. I really did. I enjoyed the feel of the rivet gun. It was powerful and strong, and I just became so proficient with it that I could twirl it and make it do everything I wanted, and it was just like a third arm to me. And I really prided myself on being probably the best riveter in the world, and hence one day I realized I was the quintessential shop rat and the greatest riveter in the world, and I so deemed myself Rivet Head. This all happened in the span of about 30 seconds, and there were no news bulletins about the occasion at all.
And hence the name of your book, of course.
Yes.
You also write about watching the clock. I mean, the almost the torture of watching the clock during the day. How did it haunt you, just the passage of time?
Oh, it would just crawl because, you know, they'd have clocks stationed everywhere. I think it was just sort of a sadistic gesture on GM's part to put all these clocks everywhere. And if you got in the habit of doing your job and then sitting down waiting for the next job to come and staring at that clock, you would swear that thing was not moving, not budging, and time would go so slow. I've often said, and I'd like to repeat here, that my main gripe was not with GM, as with their clocks. Is with the clock. That was our enemy. It wasn't General Motors, you know. General Motors, you know, they were culprits in a lot of stupid buffoonery, but those clocks were our main enemies, and making them move was our goal each day through any kind of diversion we could think up.
Would you have been better off without a clock?
Certainly, I think so. I mean, most guys wore watches anyway, but at least with the watch you could sort of control it. I can remember, I will not look at my watch, you know, for what I think will be an hour. And then I would think an hour would pass, and I'd look at my watch, and like 9 minutes passed, and I would go, oh, my God.
Ben Hamper is my guest, and he's written a book called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. It's about his years as a shop rat, an auto worker on the assembly line at General Motors Truck and Bus Plant in Flint, Michigan. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Ben Hamper is my guest. His book is called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. When did you begin to write for the Flint Voice?
I believe somewhere around 1980, 1981.
And it was Michael Moore that...
Yeah, Michael Moore. He was the editor of the paper, and we had met, and we became friendly. And at first, I wasn't writing at all about the shop, but he kept edging me in that direction, always telling me that he thought that would be a very, very good thing in this town in Flint, Michigan. People would be interested in, and I resisted. But finally I gave in. I started writing the column called Impressions of a Rivet Head, biweekly, And it proved to be probably the most popular thing in the paper and generated more mail and everything else than anything else. So we stuck with it, you know. Mama didn't raise no, you know, dunce, you know. I just, you know, grabbed the golden udders and kept them milking, you know.
You had an open-ended invitation to Roger Smith, who was head of General Motors, to go bowling with you. Were you truly serious?
Oh, yeah. I really was. You know, to me, and I still don't understand GM completely, they have no sense of humor or anything. They would pipe up all the time about how management and the workers had to come closer together to, you know, to smash down these walls of animosity and, you know, we're all one team and this and that. And so here I am extending in my column quite often the invitation for Roger Smith and me to go bowling some Friday night, like, say, a guy would at a gas station with his boss, you know, just to prove. And this would have gotten just incredible PR, you know. I can imagine all the networks there to see, you know. And I was offering, no one else was offering to do this, so I took it on myself. The rivet head, you know, bowling with Roger Smith, and it'd be a very friendly thing, and, you know, no wagering. We would just, you know, he'd drink his scotch, and I'd drink my pitcher of beer, and, you know, it didn't matter who would win, you know. It wasn't a challenge, you know, like, hey, we can beat you, you know. We represent the workers, and we represent, you know, management. But they never followed through, but then again, you know, they're always known for shooting themselves in the foot.
What do you think Roger Smith and others' idea then of developing this sense of purpose and comradeship? How did they do it? Was it just these once a year kind of family invitations to the factory? Or did they have other things that they did too?
I'm not aware of any other things they did, no. A story I do have show you sort of where Roger was at with his relationship to his, you know, millions of underlings. One day he was scheduled to come to our plant, the Flint Truck and Bus Assembly Plant, to view these new military vehicles. We had just finished the first batch of them, and he was going to show them off to some admirals or some generals or something. And everyone was very excited by the fact that he was going to show up that day, and we thought, you know, he'll probably be walking down the aisle with bodyguards and waving, and we were all quite excited. We were going to see the head honcho, you know, the chairman of the board, B-O-R-E-D. And sure enough, like 3 hours into the shift, the foreman came around informing us that we were all being sent home. And I asked the foreman why, and he says, well, no particular reason. I said, well, is there a shortage of parts? Is there a breakdown? No, no. We're just sending you home today. And then it dawned on me finally that they were sending us all home so Roger wouldn't be polluted with the sight of all of us shop rats, you know, dirtying up the atmosphere. I really took umbrage, and I was really, really angry about the whole situation after that, and I wrote about it because, you know, what was a factory without factory workers? How did trucks get assembled without assemblers? And what they were doing was kicking us out so when Roger came through the plant, it would all be sterile and quiet, you know. Not a real factory.
How would you improve things there? What would you do?
I don't know. I don't know. I think I would have a system where the jobs got rotated so people weren't stuck on the same job for years and years and years, you know, and just, you know, rotted away on these things. And a guy couldn't just keep one job that was really good while his neighbor worked his butt off three times as hard and got paid the same amount of money. I would rotate jobs like every 6 months, you know. And I'd also smash the walls down and put in windows.
There are no windows?
No, there are no windows, you know. And you never tell if it was day or night or raining or sunny, you know. And I remember a couple times they had tornadoes go by and we didn't even know about it. We'd get out of the shop and, you know, it's so noisy in there, you know. We'd turn on the radio driving home, and yes, the tornado that went right through near the GM truck and bus plant 4 hours ago. We're going, what? Tornado? So that was the noise up on the roof, huh?
Ben Hamper is my guest. His book is called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. It's about his years working on the assembly line at the General Motors truck and bus plant in Flint, Michigan. You had a nervous breakdown. Is that right?
I wouldn't.
Would you call it that?
No.
What would you call it?
I had a series of very severe panic disorder episodes.
What do you think they were caused by?
To this day, I have no idea. You know, it came out of the clear blue, and I'm sure they were exacerbated by my. Is that the right word? Oh,
I think
that's
so.
That's like a five-syllable word. Well, I think they were exacerbated by my working at GM because it lends itself to a very claustrophobic environment. And like I said earlier, the shot began to wear on my nerves. People seemed stacked, you know, too close together. There were no windows. It was so noisy, you know, and I just got this feeling of suffocation after a while. And one night it all broke loose on me. It was just an average shift, and I was, in fact, I was on break, and I was reading the sports page, and everything just went totally crazy. My heart went beating crazy, my arms tingled, my legs tingled, my vision went all to hell, and I immediately left the plant, and a few days later saw a doctor when this started to reoccur, and was soon put in a mental health clinic where you saw me and Roger and me, and was diagnosed as having panic disorder.
When was the last time you had one?
About 4 minutes ago. No. When they told me I couldn't have another cigarette. No, I don't know. You know, I still have anxiety attacks and stuff, a full-blown panic attack. It's been a while, a couple months, you know. But, you know, I don't blame this. I don't put this at the foot of GM because I would also experience these things like in shopping centers, at red lights, you know, standing in line to buy razor blades. So.
You left GM, but I wonder how much you've been able to get it out of your system.
It's been difficult because I had planned to work there. Of course, I'd be laid off anyway, as it turns out. But, you know, I had planned to, I had a good thing going. You know, I was making good money, and I had just gotten remarried, so I obviously needed money, money. And, you know, it was entwined with the thing I was starting to love, my hobby, this writing thing. So I had so much vested in returning to GM. But I was just unable to do it. And finally, the doctor that I was seeing just disallowed it, said, look, you've had it. I'm not going to send you back there anymore. And it was just sort of a farewell to arms and legs and toes and, you know, all the things that get chopped off in rivet guns.
Can you make a living on your writing? Is that where you're putting your energies now?
Yeah. I don't know how to do anything else. Not that I know how to write, but I think I did a good job on Rivethead. It's generating a lot of response, positive reviews, and hopefully that will lead to another book contract that we're already discussing.
So you're not a shop rat, you're a writer now?
Yeah, unfortunately. I like to do both, but I can't. So.
Well, I thank you very much, Ben Hamper, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
I've had fun. It's been a privilege.
Ben Hamper's new book is called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with Fresh Air. Coming up, a conversation with Israeli filmmaker Iran Rickless. His new film, called Cup Final, is about an Israeli reservist who's captured by Palestinians during the 1982 invasion of Lebanon. At the same time, the World Cup soccer finals are going on in Barcelona. The soldier finds that despite political differences, he and his captors can get along when it comes to their passion for soccer. Also, the author of the bestseller Love's Executioner has a new novel out. Book critic John Leonard has a review of When Nietzsche Wept by Irvin D. Yalom. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush gave a preview of expected campaign themes as he arrived in Houston for the Republican National Convention. Speaking a short while ago at the Astro Hall, Mr. Bush called on supporters to say who they trust to do what's right for the country. As to reports that Democratic presidential contender Bill Clinton is considering possible cabinet members, Mr. Bush said it's a little too early to start redecorating the White House.
And I half expected when I went over to the Oval Office to find him over there measuring the drapes. Well, let me say it's a first shot out of the barrel. I have a message for him. Put those drapes on hold. It is going to be curtain times for that ticket. And I mean it.
Mr. Bush also had words of praise for his running mate, Vice President Quayle. Quayle arrived earlier today in Houston, and among his first stops was a God and Country rally sponsored by the Reverend Pat Robertson. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
A few protesters were hauled out of the room during Quayle's speech, protesters from right to left. One critical of the administration's Israeli policy, several AIDS activists, and one conservative yelling that Quayle and the Bush administration were lying about their devotion to Christian values. But Quayle got a rousing reception as he proudly recalled his criticism of the Murphy Brown TV series and its sympathetic depiction of a woman's decision to bear and raise a child out of wedlock.
I don't care what the media say. I don't care what my critics say. I will never back down from talking about traditional values in our society.
Vice President Dan Quayle. I'm Nina Totenberg in Houston.
And a few miles from the GOP convention, activists on both sides of the abortion question rallied outside of clinics today where abortions are performed. Deborah Frazier of member station KUHF reports more than 30 anti-abortion activists were arrested.
A few hundred abortion rights activists formed lines this morning to protect the West Loop Clinic, while several dozen anti-abortion protesters charged the line and broke through, reaching the clinic entrance. They were greeted by Houston police officers who carried them into a bus. Most of the arrests were on trespassing charges. Soon after, about a dozen more anti-abortion activists ran through a police line of several dozen officers and dove under the front of a police van clinging to the bumper. They, too, were carried off on stretchers and arrested without incident. Anti-abortion leaders continue to say their efforts are worth it if just one life is saved, while abortion rights supporters say the clinic that was stormed today was not performing abortions, it was an administrative day. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Frazier in Houston.
The Dow Jones Industrials moved down 4 points. This is NPR News. UN inspectors have ended a 10-day trip to Iraq, and spokesmen say that they have found considerable information concerning missile programs. The team plans to leave Baghdad tomorrow. A spokesman said inspectors had completed their program and have learned things that will be useful in the future. Last month, there was a standoff when another UN inspection team tried to look at a government building in Baghdad, and a 3-week impasse occurred. It ended only after UN coalition members threatened a possible use of force. An advanced contingent of American troops arrived in Kenya today to help organize an emergency food airlift for neighboring Somalia, where more than 1 million people face possible starvation. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
33 U.S. soldiers flew into the Kenyan port city of Mombasa, which will be the main staging area for the U.S. airlift. From there, they'll make fact-finding trips into Somalia to determine what airplanes will be needed for the relief operation, which is expected to get fully underway in a week. Plans for the airlift were announced last Friday when the Bush administration pledged 145,000 tons in additional food aid for the Somalis. Anarchy in Somalia's port cities makes it difficult to get food into the country by sea. The American airlift will alleviate that problem by taking food directly to towns in the interior where relief operations can operate safely. The United Nations plans to send 500 troops to Mogadishu, the Somalian capital, in hopes that the port there can be used more efficiently in the near future. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The White House says that President Bush has now lifted a ban on U.S. air cargo flights to Lebanon because of what it termed improved security conditions. In 1985, all U.S. transportation services to Lebanon were banned because of fighting there. And the first tropical storm of the season has formed. It's named Andrew and is located in the mid-Atlantic. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The conflict between Israelis and Palestinians is one of the most trying issues of our day. Israeli filmmaker Iran Riklis deals with the problem in his new film, Cup Final. It's now playing at the Film Forum in New York and will be opening in other cities around the country later this fall. Cup Final, which is in Hebrew, Arabic, and English, has been praised for its humane, comic, and subtly surrealistic look at war. Riklis was born in Israel but grew up in Canada, the United States, Brazil, and England. He returned to Israel and served in the Yom Kippur War. Cup Final deals with Israel's war with Lebanon a decade later. Riklis read a news story about a 19-year-old Israeli soldier who was captured by a group of Palestinians and treated quite well. When they, in turn, were captured by Israeli soldiers, he asked that his Palestinian captors be released. In Riklis's film version of events, the Israeli soldier is a passionate soccer fan and shares this obsession with the leader of the Palestinian fighters. I asked Iran Riklis if he was interested in humanizing the conflicts between Israelis and Palestinians.
Yeah, look, I think my approach is, I'm not a political filmmaker as such, and even though anything you do, I think, especially in the Middle East, is political. You know, if you raise a glass of water in your right hand and you're a right winger, and if it's left hand, you're a left winger. So, but, yeah, I mean, my approach, my whole approach to politics, I think, and to the whole issue, which is a very delicate one, is from a humanistic point of view. And in that sense, I suppose my cinematic background derives itself from people like Renoir, you know, the French director. So it's really a humanistic approach to obviously heavily charged issue and very political issue.
Well, do you feel forced as a filmmaker to be political, whether you want to or not?
Well, I feel forced to be relevant. I think that's my main concern. I'm a great believer in relevant cinema, which, although I think the packaging must be, and I think that's what I've done in this film, I hope that's what I've done in this film, is I think the package should be entertaining or approachable. I mean, I would hate this film to be, you know, a kind of scratched, black and white, long, boring film, which could raise important issues, but nobody would want to see. So I think the packaging has to be entertaining. I think the packaging I gave this film is almost American in a way, or kind of Hollywood, your kind of Lost Platoon type of film.
How have Palestinians been portrayed in Israeli-made films, other Israeli-made films?
Well, they've rarely been portrayed, in fact. I mean, the problem is, I think, is Palestinians suffer from two major approaches in world cinema. I mean, I think, you know, American cinema has treated them as, you know, a bunch of hot-headed, crazy murderers normally. And even though they're normally played by Israeli actors in all the kind of, you know, action American films. But an Israeli film, I think, I mean, there have been films which treated Palestinians fairly, I think. But I think probably Cup Final is new in the sense that it gave the floor. I mean, if you have kind of, you know, 10 major characters in the film, 8 of them are Palestinians. So I think the floor is given to both sides in a kind of fair and even-handed way. And that's probably a new thing.
A more three-dimensional portrait then.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you think, I mean, for example, if you think about American films which dealt with Vietnam, which, you know, for me, Lebanon is very much the same as Vietnam was for the Americans. I can't recall any American film which, you know, showed us Vietnamese as human beings. They're normally just shadows backlit with fire all around them, or they're just, you know, bashing the heads of the American prisoners. you know, I try to really, yeah, to treat them as you know, as normal people, which they are. I mean, it's quite obvious, I think. So that was the whole reasoning behind the film.
Cohen is the Israeli reservist who's captured by this group of Palestinian fighters. And he says that the war, and this is in the beginning of the film, that the war in Lebanon is really interfering with his plans to live a normal life. And part of that is that he's got tickets to see the World Cup soccer games in Barcelona. Mm-hmm. And then he says they, and I assume he's meaning Israeli leaders, they could have some consideration for the ticket-buying public.
Yeah.
He sounds like the words of a war-weary soldier.
He is, although he also says, you know, when one of the other soldiers tells him, well, you shouldn't have voted for the Likud, he says, well, what do you want? Do you want us to sit in shelters all the time? I think, you know, initially when Cohen goes to war, and this could have been an alternative title to the film, I suppose, Cohen Goes to War.
Right.
He is weary of war because I think all Israelis are. Yeah, and I think the 1982 war in Lebanon is obviously the most controversial war Israel ever had. But initially in the first, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 days, I think most people sort of thought, okay, you know, we're going into Lebanon, we're going to wipe out the Palestinian, or the PLO, and it's a justified war. And I think, I'm sure that Cohen, despite the interference with his, you know, wonderful plans to go to Barcelona and all the reservations he has for, and you know, all the women he's intending to meet there, he still, it's complicated. I think he still thinks, you know, this is a just war, and I'm sure he's sort of thinking, okay, this will be over in 2-3 days, as was promised initially.
And then I can get back to my life.
Yeah, at least I can catch the quarterfinals in Barcelona, you know. So I think in that sense he really represents a common approach among the kind of, you know, and I'm saying this with caution, the kind of every man is the Israeli every man, because, you know, they, on one hand, everybody worries about his own private life and wants to do good in business and just enjoy a good life. On the other hand, there is a kind of feeling of cooperation, I suppose, with the government in the sense, in defense matters at least.
Well, I noticed that much of the film, and in the film we watch Cohen and these Palestinian fighters, they're wandering through Beirut. They stumble into houses where they can find a television set where they can watch the soccer match, and then they wander out into the real chaos of the country. And the movie is so much, the conversations of the movie are so much between wanting to have a normal discussion about soccer, about one's family, and then these discussions erupting into these political discussions, these arguments about Palestinians and about Israelis and their rights to the land.
Well, I think that's the way it is, you know, and I'm sure it's probably the same thing all over the world, especially in areas where politics interfere with daily life on a constant basis. And certainly in Israel, you can't go through the day, whatever you're doing, making a film or anything else, without politics sort of, you know, bursting in. Even if the door is locked and you're kind of trying to say, you know, go away.
This is for the game today. Gate number 5, you see? Here, in the middle, here, that's me, here.
Gate number 5, a lot of money.
A lot of money I lost in this war. A lot of money.
Israel is not in the World Cup this year.
Israel almost, almost. But in 1970 in Mexico, then we had a very good team. Very, very good team. We played together, yes? Spiegler, Spiegel, Schum. But now we are not enough, you know.
Now you are good with wars.
Yes. Ah, no, no. I mean, our government is too busy. Our players are too busy.
Busy with war?
No, busy with money. Everybody wants more money.
You are all capitalists there, yes? Even your socialists are capitalists.
Capitalist, socialist, communist, everybody wants more money.
They all leave to America to make money. Yeah? That's the way of the Jews. Yeah?
I will never leave to America. Never.
You seem to be saying that if people who normally view each other as enemies, if they can get to know each other, if they can share family photos, a love of a sport, if they can dance together, then they can overcome years of hostilities. Do you believe that?
Well, I don't want to sound naive, and so I kind of believe it and I don't believe it. All I can say is, my personal experience as a filmmaker and as an Israeli citizen, And my experience traveling around the world now with this film, which I've been to, you know, four corners of the world, I've met a lot of Palestinians outside of Israel and a lot of Palestinians in Israel, and a lot of people who are working with me, or Palestinians or Israeli Arabs or whatever you want to call it. And I think, you know, once you have a working relationship or just a friendship, things suddenly seem very simple, you know. So you can argue about, you know, Italy winning or not winning the World Cup, but things tend to be suddenly very basic, you know. It's kind of the necessities of life which form the relationships. And as usual, I think, you know, the high politics kind of disregard the players in the field, you know, and intervene in the kind of normal course of people behaving with each other. I think once there's normal commerce between Israelis and Arabs, a normal cultural exchange, etc., I think probably things will be made easier. This, again, as I said, I'm not naive. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of strong emotions involved, a lot of prejudice involved, a lot of history involved, which is difficult to overcome. But you know what? I think the results of the last elections in Israel show, in a way, that a larger number of people in Israel are becoming aware of the fact that, yeah, you know, that's it. We're fed up. We want to sit down and talk. We want to sort things out. So I think that's a good reflection of you know, of personal ideas that people have suddenly getting some kind of political force, which has, you know, overthrown the Likud government, which was there in power for 15 years.
I'm speaking with Israeli filmmaker Eran Rickles about his film called Cup Final, and it's about the relationship that develops between an Israeli soldier and a group of Palestinians who capture him during Israel's war with Lebanon. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Israeli filmmaker Eran Rickles. Your cast and crew of this film, Cup Final, were both Israelis and Palestinians.
Yeah.
Is that unusual in Israel?
Well, I think, you know, this film, I had one rule when I was casting this film, that Arabs would play Arabs and Jews would play Jews. And I tried to stick, I mean, actually, I stuck to that all the way from the commander of the group and all the way down to the small kid in the wedding. I mean, it's because I thought for these kind of characters, which are rather three-dimensional and have a lot of history around behind them, it was important to have actors who would have some kind of bearing on their role and wouldn't have to go and start, you know, reading books about it. So whether it's unusual or not, I mean, you have to realize that all the Arab Israelis who play in this film are all well-known stars in Israel. Some of them are in the, you know, theater, some of them are in television and films. It's not as if I've discovered something. Mm. But it's probably the first Israeli film which has such a major cast of Arab Israelis.
And were there political discussions behind the scenes the way we see them in the movie?
Well, I think they were resolved before the actual shoot, because what I did is I had a five-week session of rehearsals, which beyond just working with the actors and then doing a lot of work individually with them and as a group, I really tried to kind of sort out all the potential tensions or political tensions before the actual shoot, because when you're shooting for, you know, 33 days, you can't really afford to start having arguments on the set. I think what's interesting, though, is that when the film was released, some of them had some major problems with it.
In what way?
In the way that there was a lot of pressure from Arab press, Arab communist press in Israel, sort of saying, you know, how come an Arab actor is playing in a Zionist film? Because you have to realize this film was in Israel. It was attacked from every possible angle. I mean, the right wing said it was a PLO film. The left wing said it was a right wing film. You know, it was almost an impossible situation.
Probably tells you you're onto something when you get that kind of reaction.
Yeah, yeah. Although, unfortunately, the film didn't do very well in Israel, and it kind of had a totally different career in Israel and abroad. Because as an Israeli film, it's a major success in Europe, and now it's opening here in the States, it's already got some great reviews. And so I don't know, it's kind of like looking at two different films. It's rather weird, even for me today, with a perspective of a few months already.
Well, let me get back to what you were saying about the kind of criticism then that the actors got from their respective presses, I guess. How do they have an answer to that, or did you have an answer to that?
Well, you know, it's funny. On the eve of the premiere in Jerusalem, Emil Habibi, who's a very prominent, is the most prominent Arab writer in Israel, who I didn't know personally, came up to me after the screening and hugged me and said, "Eran, this is the most exciting experience I've had over the past 10 years. And I love the film, but I want to warn you, next week you're going to be attacked, at least by the Arab press, from every possible angle. And to counterattack that, I'm going to write a big article and publish it all over the Arab world and all that." I don't know, I think there was a kind of emotional problem which the Arab media, at least, had with the sense that, you know, how come an Israeli is coming down here and making a film about us? You know, what right does he have, in a way? Which to me is a bit awkward and strange, and I kind of, you know, I can't really cope with that. I mean, it's
do you have an answer for that?
Well, I think it's absurd. I mean, I think the film is about breaking barriers between, you know, who cares if you're an Israeli or an Arab or whatever. I mean, so, you know, why can't an Israeli make a film about Arabs and vice versa, you know? And although, on the other hand, what I did say is I said, look, this film is not a commissioned film, you know, and I think this film was not, you know, made by the PLO and was not made by the Israeli government. It wasn't made by anyone, kind of. It wasn't commissioned by anyone. It was made by private people with private points of view. And I think with respect for everyone, and I think that's what you should respect, because, you know, this film is fair. Notwithstanding the fact that it was made by an Israeli, and you can't avoid that. And I'll be very glad to see a Palestinian directing a film about, you know, the same subject.
What is your next project?
Well, I have two next projects, actually. One is a kind of story of an Oriental singer in Israel, who, it's your kind of Jim Morrison kind of story, you know, drugs, sex, and rock and roll, but with a kind of Sephardic Jews version, which all has all to do with the kind of social phenomenon in early 80s in Israel, with, you know, the conservatives coming to power, the kind of Oriental Jews suddenly changing their status in the country and all of that. And so that's my immediate project, which I'm going to do very soon. And then right after that, I have a much more ambitious and bigger project, which is called Jealous God.
Huh, what's that?
Which is all about a character called Shapira, who lived in Jerusalem in the 19th century and who one day claimed, he was a forger and kind of quite a character, who one day claimed that he discovered what's called today the Dead Sea Scrolls. And at that time, it was a kind of, you know, world sensation, because it was kind of the first proof to the word of God, you know. And he went to London, he was offered £1 million by the British Museum, and then it was claimed that the whole thing is a huge forgery and the whole deal fell through. That's a kind of a story of a guy who tries to conquer the world and fails and just burns in the process, I suppose.
Eran Rickless, thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Eran Rickless's film Cup Final is playing in New York at the Film Forum. It will open in other cities around the country later this fall. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about today's show. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. Linda Wertheimer reports from the Republican Convention in Houston on the platform maneuvering today. The issue has been settled. There is a strong anti-abortion plank in the platform. John Burnett reports on the oil industry's assessment of George Bush's performance. Many of the oil folks in Houston are not happy with the president. Also, we'll talk with Roddy Doyle about his new novel entitled The Van. The story is about an unemployed plasterer in a suburb of Dublin. This book features many of the same characters from the book and then the movie, The Commitments, also by Roddy Doyle.
Noah, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio. Irvin D. Yalom is a psychiatrist who's written about psychotherapy in textbooks and nonfiction books, including the bestseller Love's Executioner. His new book, When Nietzsche Wept, mixes fact with fiction. Critic John Leonard has this review.
When Basic Books publishes a novel, we may be sure that it will be high-minded. What we worry about is whether it will also be any fun. When Nietzsche Wept is both. Irvin D. Yalom, a professor of psychiatry at Stanford, has reimagined a year, 1882 in Vienna, in the middle of all that late 19th century intellectual hubbub that gave us so many of our distinctively modern anxieties about philosophy, music, art, and politics. If a playwright like Tom Stoppard can put James Joyce and Vladimir Ilyich Lenin together in Zurich, even though they never met, why shouldn't a novelist like Yalom put the misogynistic Zarathustran, Friedrich Nietzsche, together in Vienna with Dr. Joseph Breuer, one of the founding fathers of psychoanalysis, even though they never met. And Nietzsche is known to have hated Vienna because it rattled his cold bones. What happens is that Joseph Breuer, while on vacation from Vienna in Venice, is approached by Lou Salome. Lou, you may remember, was the Russian-born German novelist and cutie pie, a sort of 19th-century cross between Susan Sontag and Susan Sarandon, who trifled in her time with the affections of Nietzsche and Freud and Rainer Maria Rilke, before marrying an Orientalist. In 1882, Lou is 21 years old, and she's worried about Fred, who's 38 and mad at her and threatens suicide. Joe is a 40-year-old Viennese physician who makes house calls in a horse-drawn buggy. He is also renowned for his talking cure of the pseudonymous Anna O. Lou asks Joe to undertake a similar talking cure of Fred, but to do it secretly, because Fred's too proud to submit his mind for repairs to any mere mortal, and besides would resent Lou's interference. Little does Lou know that Joe is extremely unhappy about Anna O, whose real name is Bertha. Joe's supposed to be a happily married man, but ever since this talking cure, all he thinks about are Bertha's breasts. Never mind how Joe gets Fred into a Viennese hospital. It has something to do with Wagner and migraines. What's important, and hugely entertaining here, is that while Joe thinks he is curing Fred of his despair, Fred is actually curing Joe of his midlife crisis. It will not perhaps surprise you to learn that Joe's mother's name was also Bertha. Meanwhile, there's this medical student, to whom Joe's a mentor, and who keeps popping in and out of the narrative with some odd notions about dreams. His name is Sigmund. Later on, Joe and Sig will, of course, co-author Studies in Hysteria, and Fred will write Thus Spake Zarathustra, not to mention Beyond Good and Evil. Yalom whimsically suggests that if Nietzsche had actually consulted Breuer, as he consulted so many doctors in those years, Nietzsche might have, by accident, invented psychoanalysis. Think of the myth of eternal recurrence as a kind of return of the repressed. Among the many virtues of this role in the Viennese hay is that Yalom is forever quoting Nietzsche in zippy nihilistic soundbites. That which does not kill me makes me stronger, or to love woman is to hate life. You'll remember all over again why Nietzsche seemed so important when you were 16 years old, if you were a boy. Girls, even then, were healthier.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Deborah Beagle, Joan Tuohy, and Susan Weinstein. Suze Boland directed today's show, and we welcome back Joyce Lieberman. I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Willem Dafoe. He plays a drug dealer in the new Paul Schrader film, Light Sleeper. Also, Serbian-born poet Charles Simic reflects on how the fighting in Bosnia-Herzegovina has brought back childhood memories of growing up in Yugoslavia during the Second World War. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.